For more information about Ancient Dragon Zen Gate and Tygon's teaching, please visit us at ancientdragon.org.
We are very fortunate to have a distinguished guest speaker this morning, Professor Stephen Hine from Florida International University, who will be talking about Dogen's poetry and the role of poetry in Zen and Zen practice. So I want to introduce for people who don't know, again for new people here, who Dogen is, before I say more about Stephen Hine. Dogen was the 13th century Japanese monk who founded the branch of Zen that we do here, referred to as Soto Zen. He was a Japanese monk, lived 1200 to 1253, went to China and brought back the Zen transmission in the Soto school. His writings in translation have been a very important aspect of introducing Zen to America. His writings are very profound, poetic, we could say deeply philosophical, but basically he was a meditation teacher. So he initiated or helped introduce this practice we've just been doing of Zazen or sitting meditation. So I talk about Dogen here frequently in his writings. I've myself published a few books of commentaries and a few significant translations of Dogen's writings. There's quite a lot in English now of translations of Dogen and of writings about Dogen. But we're very fortunate to have Stephen Hine here this morning, who is, I don't think there's any question, the preeminent American academic scholar of Dogen, published many very, very important books about Dogen and about Zen and about koans. Very glad he's here for the American Academy of Religion conference going on downtown now in Chicago with 10,000 religious scholars. Anyway, crawling the streets.
Sounds like fun.
So Stephen has agreed to, he's been here before and has agreed to come here this morning. So thank you very much, Stephen.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the opportunity, and it's always a pleasure to interact with Tygen and his group. And I've been here several times over the past few years since he moved to Chicago, and it's great to see everything that the group has done here over the last 4 or 5 years. Speaking on the religion professor angle, I remember when I was in undergraduate about 5 years ago. back in the late 60s, we had a professor who gave some very inspiring lectures. This was primarily on Western religious thought, existentialism, Kierkegaard, that got, helped to stimulate some of my interest in Zen Buddhism. And I remember he said that if he would go to a cocktail party and they'd say, he'd talk to somebody and they'd say, well, what do you do? And he would say, well, I'm a professor of religion. And if he was holding a cocktail in the hand, they would get very embarrassed. Like, oh, how could you be drinking, you know, if you're such a... but it's quite a diverse community. We did invade Chicago this year. It's always great to be in Chicago. Let me say a few words in addition to what Tygen said about Dogen. And Dogen as a writer. And the role of writing and literary arts and other arts in Zen as a kind of segue into the handout and some more detailed material and some translations of different kinds of poetry that Dogen wrote. And by the way, Tygen's one of his great translations, Dogen's Extensive Records with Shohaku Okumura, is a very comprehensive volume that contains a lot of material by Dogen. And in volumes 9 and 10 of that book, there are many examples of Dogen's poetry there, and that's I'll talk more about that in a few minutes. But Dogen as a writer and the role of literature in Zen, I think, cannot be overestimated. So Zen, Zen Buddhism probably began around 500-600, Bodhidharma comes from the West, from India, and Zen temples are being established in China, and in the Tang Dynasty, so that takes us from the 7th, 8th, 9th centuries, Zen Buddhism seemed to flourish, and many of the famous Zen masters that we read about in the Zen koans and other writings come from that period. Dogen's, of course, coming from a later period, around 1200, and he goes to China in 1223. So what happened in between the early period, the classical period, the source period of the great Zen teachers, and that ends around in the mid-800s or around 900, and then there was kind of a gap, and then Zen gets reinvigorated beginning around 1000. Well, in China, the dynasty switched. There was a lot of turmoil in terms of the socio-political environment, but beginning around 960, and then Zen really gets started around the year 1000. What happened was there was a big emphasis in China on the literati, on the well-read, well-educated scholar officials who managed the system, who ran the bureaucracy, who served in administrative roles, and in their leisure time, or in their time dedicated to intellectual pursuits, read and wrote poetry. And Chinese poetry was very carefully regulated with a lot of rules for rhyming, how many characters can be in a line, for the type of content, the type of imagery that you would have. And it was in that environment that Zen Buddhism particularly flourished, beginning around the year 1000 and over the next couple hundred years. And so by the time Dogen gets there in 1223, the Zen culture and the literati culture were very much interfused. And it was kind of taken for granted that if you were one of the literati, one of the scholar officials, you would probably spend time hearing Dharma talks, going to the Zen temples, befriending the important Zen masters, maybe contributing to some of their collections, maybe writing a preface or an introductory essay for some of their collections, and that these literati would be very much influenced by the teachings of Zen and would do some Zen practice. And it seems like some of the teachers in China, some of the Zen teachers in China, kind of tailored their practice for this particular group, and we refer to that practice today, which is still with us, especially in Rinzai Zen, as Watto practice, which is to focus meditation on a key phrase, like the mu, does the dog have the Buddha nature, no, or mu, and that, you know, that would be a main example. So meanwhile, on the Zen side, the Zen masters were very, coming out of the well-educated literary class, and they spent a lot of their time interacting with the non-monastics, who were poets, and they were pretty much expected to write poetry. And if we look at the collected writings of the Zen masters of that period, they just almost always have at least a couple of volumes in their collection, which is poetry. And poetry might have different purposes. Some of it would comment on their own personal reflections, kind of autobiographical reflections on how they practiced, how they studied, how they became enlightened, what it's like to be a teacher. Some of them were more formal occasions. If it was an anniversary of the Buddha's birthday, or the emperor's birthday, because they were part of the state. The monasteries were kind of regulated by the state system. They would often compose poetry as part of that ceremonial occasion. They would also, of course, write poetry commenting on koans and some of the sayings and teachings of earlier Zen masters. And it was quite a variety, and often it had a lot of rules and regulations that had to be studied. And you know, one question comes up is how good were the Zen masters as poets? Were they considered to be aesthetic in what they presented, or did they want to be? Because the tension comes in, and we see this in many examples, and we'll look at this in a few moments in Dogen. Should they be spending their time writing poetry, or is that a distraction? Does that detract from their spiritual pursuits? Does that take away from their emphasis on meditation? And a lot of times they ponder this point, and that becomes one of the topics for the poetry. Should I be writing the poetry? And they would express mixed feelings about that. Now let's, Dogen's coming from Japan, so let's look at the Japanese side. Very similar. In terms of the emphasis on the literary culture as the rulership of Japan in beginning in the 800s and building up to Dogen's era. So it was pretty much taken for granted that if you were involved in the leadership of the Buddhist circles, and you were going to be a head of a Buddhist temple, or you were going to be a prominent figure in Buddhism, that you were probably going to be very well educated and very well versed in poetry. Chinese poetry and Japanese poetry were quite different because, and we'll see examples of both, the Japanese poems that they wrote at that time were usually what's known as the waka, which is the precursor of the haiku. Haiku having 17 syllables, and the waka had 31 syllables. So that was really long by Japanese standards. And I was, you know, pretty much taken for granted that somebody like Dogen, who was born in an aristocratic family, and he apparently made a deliberate choice to pursue the Dharma and become a Buddhist teacher at around the age of 13, but he would have been trained in learning the classics in the Chinese literature that would have been transferred to Japan, and also the Japanese style of literature. And what's particularly interesting about Dogen as a writer is that he goes to China at a very interesting time in this history, because the travel between China and Japan had been not happening basically for a couple hundred years. Because of various political circumstances, the Japanese monks and other Japanese travelers, and the Japanese were not big travelers, and they didn't build very good ships, and even though the travel from Japan to China, if you look on the map, doesn't, you know, look like it's a very severe kind of trip, because it's pretty close to go from Japan to the eastern seaboard of China, around where Shanghai is. Of course, that didn't exist at the time, but one of the major cities was in that area, Hangzhou. It doesn't look like a big trip, but with the typhoons and the monsoons and all the difficulties in traveling in the waters then, and we know what happened to the Mongols when they came the other direction to invade Japan. You know, it wasn't a trip that was taken very often. And then political circumstances prevented much travel. And Dogen was one of the first, not the very first, but one of the first handful of people in a new wave of travel and communication between China and Japan. And so when he went to China, he just only spent 4 years there, but his capacity was so profound, apparently, that he was really able to master the Chinese literature and learn a variety of Chinese writings, some of the koans, some of the meditation manuals, in addition to this poetry, and bring back that knowledge to Japan, and kind of integrate it with his already profound understanding of Japanese writing. And that's why I think, that's part of why Dogen is so prominent with us today, and there's so many translations of different writings of Dogen, because he has a really literary quality. It's hard to translate sometimes because there's a lot of ambiguity and a lot of nuance and a lot of wordplay that's hard to communicate or convey the meaning in English. But that's what Dogen represents. That's what Dogen captures. So, if you look at some of the material that the modern Japanese scholarship produces, and if they have a history of literature, setting aside Buddhism for the moment, but just the history of literature, which will include some of the Buddhist teachers of Zen and other schools, Dogen's always going to be on that list. His calligraphy was quite classically formal. He's not known for the innovative calligraphy, but he had a very precise and elegant writing style for the Chinese characters. And then his literary quality was something that still considered impressive, and so his writings are included on that side of it. And so when we're looking at it from the Zen angle, from the Buddhist angle, from the Dharma angle, I think we have to take into account, what's happening with Dogen as a writer, and what does that convey, and what are the nuances and the underlying meanings and different levels of significance that come across. Now, Before we get to the material in the handout, let me say one more background concept. Actually, a couple interrelated concepts. But in the Chinese Zen at the time, in order to distinguish writing that would be considered to be useful and helpful and in meditation process and conducive to leading towards enlightenment, as opposed to writing that might be mechanical, might be kind of rote learning, might be something that would detract and occupy the mind and become a source of attachment, a distinction was generally made between what they called live words and dead words. So the live words are conducive, the dead words are something you want to avoid, is a kind of pitfall or trap. However, what are the live words and what are the dead words? How you define which could be quite different according to the schools of thought in Zen at the time. So what one person thought was a live word might be just the opposite from a rival thinker or somebody else representing a different school. But I think they all agreed that you wanted that literature could be useful, that writing had a powerful was a powerful force to communicate ideas, but at the same time, you had to avoid and eliminate the drawbacks of writing. Within that context, you know, what were the live words? Well, I think basically to simplify it, there were two schools of thought. One school of thought, which is generally referred to as the Watteau school, which means the key phrase or head word. The word Watteau can be translated different ways, but the idea is that you boil the teaching down to a minimal amount of words. Mu in the does the Dogger Buddha nature mu no is probably the single main example. Why does Buddha Dharma come from the West? One answer is there's a cypress tree in the garden. That's another example of a Watteau. So the you focus on that and you kind of eliminate the background material and other kinds of writing that would be distracting. So that's the Watteau approach. The other approach that Dogen endorsed and his school of thought endorsed can be referred to as, it happens to make an interesting rhyme in the Japanese pronunciation, as Kato. Kato is a little hard to translate, but the term is usually translated as entangling vines. And it literally refers to vines, the tendrils of vines that reach out and intersect each other. And that can be seen as a negative thing because they're kind of spreading and they're unformed and they're going in a lot of different directions. Or it could be seen as a positive image, as a metaphor for something that's very constructive when you think of it as multiple levels of understanding, variety of perspectives that you put together to try to comprehend the meaning behind the words. The phrase entangling vines, which Dogen uses, and again, some of the critics on the other side of it use it in a negative sense, but kind of goes back to early Chinese wedding ceremonies when the vines were a symbol that were used to indicate that the two marriage partners and especially their two families, their two clans, because obviously in the ancient Chinese family system that was very important. Their two clans were coming together, and the vines were used in some of the songs or odes that were being sung in the wedding rituals to indicate that intersection and the utility of that. So that's kind of what Dogen is drawing upon here. I think the idea of kato, meaning that words do play a powerful role. Okay, now in the handout we'll see that there's a different kinds of poems. Some are in Japanese, some are in Chinese. Some are for more formal occasions. Some are probably more off-the-cuff expressions that he came up with. Now, I think to start with, we always have to take into account that Dogen is very well known for a particular saying that I quote in that long first paragraph. And if you go down about 5, 6 lines, you see that there's a reference to a book called Shobogenzo Zui Monkey. The word Shobogenzo is something that Dogen liked to use. It means the treasury of the true Dharma eye. And there's a couple of his collections that use that word in the title, actually. And so we have to sort out those different collections. But Shobogenzo Zui Monkey was a collection, and it's been translated by Tom Cleary, and there's actually a couple translations available. It was a collection of sermons that apparently he gave about 10 years after he came back from China, and he was just starting his own temple in Kyoto before he moved up to the mountains. He started his mountain temple, Eheiji. When he was first starting his very own temple in Kyoto, he gave sermons maybe Dharma talks or Dharma discourses is another term that could be used, to monks that were coming out. Apparently they were coming around we heard this interesting teacher who came back from China, and they were kind of checking him out, and he was trying to coax them and persuade them to follow his way of teaching. And so that's the context for the Shobogenzo Zui Monkey. And here he says, you know, impermanence moves swiftly. The meaning of life and death is the great problem. You must follow the Buddha way and study the Buddha Dharma. The composition of literature, Chinese poetry, and Japanese poetry is worthless and must be renounced. And so that sentence is often quoted. And in Japan... you know, that's a kind of label that gets pinned on Dogen sometimes, and it's over the 800 years since his life, continues to have a very big effect. And some followers of Dogen or some other people looking at Dogen from outside of his school will say, "Well, this is Dogen's view. You can't have more than one view. This was the view." I think we think that he does have many different views, and not that he's contradicting himself, not that he's flip flopping, and Dogen would say, you know, I was for the study of poetry before I was against it, I think to us, you know, the what could be called contradictory is really paradoxical and shows that Dogen was looking at things from different perspectives. And probably for prospective monks, when he was starting his new temple in Kyoto, he wanted to emphasize Zazen only, Shikantaza, and didn't want them to get distracted by literature for its own sake, he probably uttered something like this. And that wasn't necessarily the end-all and be-all of his thinking. At the same time, if on the one end of the spectrum he says this thing about renouncing Chinese and Japanese poetry, at the other end of the spectrum he writes quite a bit of Chinese and Japanese poetry. But I think he always has a mixed feeling about it. That's what's interesting, and that's what I want to explore here. In other words, he writes about if you look at the collection, there's about. Maybe about 300 Chinese poems altogether. That's quite a lot of poems. And, you know, when you look at them, one of the interesting things is how well does he write it? You know, it's a little hard to evaluate the artistry level of it, but what you can say is that he knew Chinese very well, and he followed a lot of the Chinese rules, which meant that, you know, Chinese is a tonal language. And so the rhyme scheme depends on knowing the different tones behind the characters, that pronunciation. And Dogen is a foreigner who spent 4 years there, apparently, you know, knew that very well. Now, people say that there were kind of crib sheets at the time, that writing poetry was such an important thing, and people were trying to catch up quickly, that you could have consulted a kind of manual that would have said, okay, here's some good examples of rhyming, you know, and then you're writing your own poetry, and you could look at that manual and put that in there. And maybe Dogen relied on something like that or not. But you know, in any case, the fact that he wrote all those poems and the fact that quite a few of them are true to the Chinese form, it's quite an achievement in itself. Given that that's not his main achievement, I think we would all agree that that's just, you know, a sideline for him in a sense. It's kind of a hobby on the side. given what else he accomplished, it's still quite significant. On the Japanese side, he wrote about 60 of those waka, those 31-syllable verse. And, you know, those numbers aren't quite as significant, but again, we see that he's following the patterns, he's following the regulations, he knows how to do it, and that doesn't mean that all of them are beautiful poetry, but I think there's a lot of lessons to be learned from some of them. Now, one of the things that came up is that because he was he had made this statement to renounce poetry, within the Orthodox Soto sect in Japan, there was, they didn't know what to quite do with the fact that he had the poetry, and it wasn't something that they felt very strongly about, and a lot of times they would, it was kind of kept in the background. Then comes 1968. Kawabata Yasunari was the first Japanese novelist to win the Nobel Prize for Literature, and he goes to Stockholm and he gives his Nobel Prize acceptance speech, and Kawabata was kind of a traditionalist in the sense that he was trying to kind of recreate some of the traditional Japanese culture in a modern context. And very interesting, because in the first couple of paragraphs of his speech, he says that one of the big influences on him was Dogen, and he quotes a Dogen poem. So all of a sudden, Dogen as a poet becomes very prominent in the to the Japanese context, and there was kind of a rethinking, reevaluation, and trying to put that forward. So let's take a look at that example. Let's start with that one, actually, which is on page 3, the top of that page. And this is an example of the Japanese waka. So if you count the syllables on the Japanese side, it's 5-7-5-7-7 in those five lines. And in the English translation, I mean, generally translations don't try to duplicate the exact number of syllables because it would come out a little bit awkward. But so don't try to count them on the English side. Now, if you look at the content of that poem, could I get anybody to read that? Anybody?
In Japanese or English?
If anybody wants to read the Japanese, that's fine. Anybody want to?
Haru wa hana, natsu hoto to gisu, aki wa tsuki, fuyu yuki kiede, suzuchi kari keri.
Okay. Great, thank you. And how about the English side? Okay, please.
In spring, the cherry blossoms. In summer, the cuckoo song. In autumn, the moon shining. In winter, the frozen snow. How pure and clear are the seasons.
Okay, thank you. And then, you know, let's look at the title. Not all of them have titles, and I see that there's a couple of typos here. So the title should be Hon Lai, R-A-I, not A-R-I. And actually, the word in the fifth line, Suzushi, should be S-H-I, not C-H-I. But anyway, Honlai no Momaku, original face. Now, original face is a famous saying going back to Sixth Patriarch Kuenon. What was the look on your face before you were born is the way that's often put. And so when we look at the title compared to the content, what's the thing, what strikes us about that? What's the relation between the title, original face, and the content of the five lines of the poem?
The poem doesn't seem to be addressing specifically original face.
Right. In fact, that's a good way to put it. It does not seem to be addressing specifically. But can we say that even more strongly?
It looks like there's different original faces in the different seasons.
Well, that's true. That's good. Yes, there's different original faces of the seasons, but so it's not, you know, generally original face would be more of a psychological term, a term of self-realization, an internal term, and all these images are external because they're in the seasons. That's not that unusual. That's kind of the way the Japanese did it. They built in a paradox that the in the poems, that the title of the poem was almost deliberately refuted by the content of the poem. But then you look for the deeper meaning, as Taigen says, which is, okay, well, each of these seasons, even though they're external, they kind of have their original face. Now, this was the poem that Kawabata quoted in his lecture, and that kind of triggered off an awakening of interest in Dogen's poetry. If you look at some other translations, they do it a little bit differently, because let's go to this word suzushi. Suzushi literally means cool. And so, you know, we have the four seasons: in winter, the frozen snow, and then those last two words, Kali and Kelly, they're kind of just thrown in there as grammatical structure. They don't really have a significant meaning. So the only real meaning in the last line is the word suzushi, cool. And one way of translating is to say, okay, well, that's reinforcing the frozen snow, which is cold. Observers have pointed out is that the word suzushi in the traditional poetry in Dogen's era meant cool the way we use the word today, actually, which is that it's more of a sense of sensation. It's an impression. It's a feeling. Hey, this is cool. But not in such a trite way as we might use it, but in a way that really triggers off, or really sets us on the way of a profound thinking. So each of the original faces of the four seasons, that's something to behold. So that's why I have the translation "How pure and clear the seasons are," because it's the purity that's emphasized here. Rather than just the physicality of being cold. You don't really need to say it's cold, because the frozen snow already implies that. What we see here is that Dogen is following some of the patterns of the Japanese poetry by switching up the title with the content, and using some of the images, like this term suzushi, coming up with a poem that's going to get quoted by one of the great writers 8 centuries later, even though he is said to renounce it. Now let's take a look at the next one, which also deals with the with seasonal imagery. So, how about the English on the next one?
Crimson leaves whitened by the season's first snow. Is there anyone who would not be moved to celebrate this in song?
Okay. Now here the title seems pretty direct. And big snowfall, 9th month, 25th day. And the Japanese follow a lunar calendar. So that's why I translate it that way, because it's not exactly September 25th, but it's early autumn. And what happened was, if you look at Dogen's biography, this was around the time he had first moved up from Kyoto, which is a beautiful city, and it can also get kind of cold there. It's in the mountains, but he moved up into the high mountain areas, several hour train ride north of Kyoto. And it snows a lot there, apparently. They get the Siberian, it's kind of in northwestern Japan, they get the Siberian blasts that bring a lot of snowfall to that area. Dogen, if you look at a lot of his writing about nature and about the seasons, he talks a lot about the snow when he's up in those mountains. So I think it was something that had an impact on him. But any thoughts on the significance of this verse?
He's playing with color. There's the red and the white, but there's also the idea of it being moving. There's some emotion there.
Right. Okay. So the autumn leaves are red, and the snow is white, and And that creates a certain image or feeling. And so let's go to the last two lines. In light of the original statement about renouncing poetry, what's
right, I mean, he's basically saying we need to write poems when we have some strong feeling.
Yeah. Right, the word uta literally means song, but like in China and Japan and probably a lot of traditional cultures, formal poetry came out of tradition of singing ritual songs for ceremonies, and then it developed into more of a the personal statement of the poet. I think you go back to the Greeks, you can see that development as well. So the word uta can be song, but by this point in history, it can mean poem. And what he's saying is, if you look at that example in nature, the simple but very overwhelmingly beautiful example in nature, this emotion wells up and you want to express it. Does he seem satisfied with that feeling, or is there a tension about it, or what impression do we get by what he says here?
I guess I'm not sure. Is this more of a rhetorical question, or is he really asking that? Is it like, who wouldn't be, or is it more, is there someone who would not be moved by this?
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, that's a very good way to put it, and I think to me it's both. I mean, I think it's a rhetorical question in the sense that, yeah, well, of course I'm going to write this poem, but there's a deeper level of it. It's not just, of course I am. It's kind of like, well, I'm going to do it in spite of myself. That's how I...
The reservation earlier.
Yeah. 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 So I think that's what makes it so interesting, because you can feel the reservation. He wants to hold back. He knows better on a certain level. He realizes he's kind of contradicting himself, and yet the emotion is so strong that he can't help do it. And if he's going to do it, he's going to do it according to the style that's going to follow the rules that's part of the conventional way of doing things. If we look at that pair of the poems together, we get the feeling that that he's fascinated by the natural environment, maybe a little bit overwhelmed by the snow fall in the high mountains where he's now located, but at the same time, he goes back to a very basic ingredient of Asian culture, which is the rotation of the four seasons. And, you know, you find this basic in the basic yin-yang ideas and in early Taoism, and you find this over and over again in various examples of the literature and culture in China and Japan. And the rotation of the seasons is something that is going to teach you a lesson about the flux of existence and the flow of human life from birth to death. And then in the first one, we get like each season is kind of discrete, and each one has its own original phase. It has its own essential meaning, and we build up. But yet the fifth line, the way I interpret the fifth line, kind of combines the overall feeling into one package. What's interesting about the second verse, Crimson Leaves on the Snow, is that there's a the intersection between the two seasons. Like the snowfall is already, representing winter, is already intruding into the fall, and that overlap kind of intensifies the impressionism that he's going to get from observing the seasons. Now, to look at a couple of other examples, let's go back to page one. And Dogen's teacher, Ru Jing. Well, I guess this handout has kind of the old-fashioned way of transliterating the Chinese J-U-C-H-I-N-G for the teacher's name, but it's pronounced more like Ru, and you usually see it R-U-G-I-N-G. So Anyway, Dogen's teacher in China was the one who taught him and enlightened him, and Dogen considered, when he went back to Japan, that he was a Ruijing student, and he was spreading the teaching about Ruijing. One of the things that the Chinese teachers wrote poetry about was in anticipation of their death. So there, you know, there's a lot of stories and maybe legends about the Zen masters dying in the Zazen position, and when they were they had a premonition or awareness of the death coming on, they would sit in Zazen and prepare to die in that position, and that's what is said of Dogen as well. But in any case, they almost always leave us with a poem, and the teacher leaves a poem, and then his student is supposed to kind of creatively imitate, let's say, imitate, you know, not in a negative sense, but creatively emulate the poem of the teacher. So if we let's take Ruijing's poem there, the first one under Death First. Could somebody read that one, please?
For 66 years, committing terrible sins against heaven, now leaping beyond, while still alive, plunging into the yellow springs, amazing, I used to believe that life and death were unrelated.
Okay, Yellow Springs is kind of is part of the traditional Chinese mythology for the realm of death, for the underworld. It might be translated as hell, but not so much in the sense of a realm of punishment, but just that's where the spirits go at the time of death. So if we had to characterize the impression that Ruijing is leaving us in one or two words, as he anticipates death, what might that be?
Already died.
Yeah, I mean, seeing into the death kind of having taken place, and what's his attitude towards it?
Almost welcoming it. It says he's leaping and plunging into the yellow springs, and that now I used to believe that life and death were unrelated, but
right. Okay, so he's welcoming, and if we go back to the line two, what's expressed in line two?
Regrets.
What's that?
His regrets.
Okay, so a kind of repentant view. Now, you know, probably as a great Zen master, his sins were not so terrible, probably. But, you know, I mean, he probably means that a little bit tongue-in-cheek there. But, you know, like everybody else, when you have the near-death experience, you know, the some images in your life kind of flash before you, perhaps, and you know, he probably has some regrets about not everything was perfect, and so there, you know, I think repentance here in a good natured kind of tongue in cheek way, but also in a profound way, that he's willing to admit and cast off whatever limitations in his personality or character or teaching style, as he anticipates and maybe kind of eagerly. All right, you know, I'm not going to hold back now. I know my time has come, so I leap into it. And in a sense, death has already happened because, you know, I realize that death, life and death are one. So he overcomes that final duality. Like the famous koan about the putting the water buffalo through the window and everything goes through but the tail. So it seems like for him, the tail, the last sins are thinking there was a separation of life and death, and now he's embracing. So let's take Dogen's. Obviously, he didn't live quite as long, so the number of years changes. But if we look at the words in Dogen's poem, What's similar and what's different? He uses some of the same phrasing.
Let me read the poem, Dogen's version, Dogen's death poem. For 54 years, following the way of heaven, now leaping beyond, shattering every barrier, amazing, to cast off attachments while still alive, plunging into the yellow springs.
Okay, thank you. And so what are some of the similar phrases that he uses?
Well, the second line is the obvious difference. And maybe it perhaps means that by his following the way of heaven, he was living with death over his left shoulder,
mm-hmm.
whereas his master was disregarding it for those 66 years.
Right. Okay. So he's kind of playing on the master's image, but
he's received the teaching of, hey, death is part of it.
Right. He's showing that he received that final teaching, and maybe he's gone beyond the master in the positive sense that the master wants the student to be able to surpass him eventually. So, yeah, I hadn't thought of it that way, but I think you put it very nicely, quite that way. But following the way of heaven, as opposed to committing terrible sins against heaven, yeah, following the way of heaven means that he learned that lesson that Rujin gets to in the final line, that life and death are one. Yeah.
Is it possible? I read his master's second line as sort of a way of saying that in Zen, that whatever we do, we're sort of committing sins because when we start to describe it or when we, you know, follow it, that there's, it's that more tongue-in-cheek kind of way of approaching it, that no matter what you do, mm-hmm. you can see it that way as committing a sin.
Mm-hmm.
And what I see Dogen doing is saying that sinning is following the way of heaven.
Mm-hmm.
So he's not contradicting or saying, hey, I figured out something, but it's almost reemphasizing the other side of it.
Mm-hmm. Good, yes, yeah. The phrase Yellow Springs is, plunging into Yellow Springs while still alive is something they have in common. And one of the things to say about the poetry from that era is that you're supposed to borrow heavily from the predecessor. It's not considered unoriginal. But you take the predecessor's words, you play with it a little bit, you tweak it, you bring in a subtle emphasis, as these comments have indicated. Okay, do we have time for a couple more? Or?
Just a couple.
Okay. All right. Well, one of the things Dogen liked to do was to play off of his teacher's poems. And so, apparently, we get a sense from some things that Dogen writes that Rujin, when Dogen was studying with Rujin in a monastery in China, that Rujin, let's say at the time of the full moon, would take his group of monks out and say, hey, there's the full moon, and it's going to last 3 nights, basically. It's going to come be full and start to subside. So each night, each of you will write a poem, and we'll have a sort of, informal contest, let's say. And that was part of the context of Dogen's learning experience. And so there's a couple of examples in the collection where he cites Rujing, and then he has his own version. So let's take that one. Could anybody read the two versions? Bottom of page one, top of page. Yes, please.
So which one are you?
Bottom of page one and top of page two.
Okay. A rewriting of Rujing's verse on the meaning of the sound of the bell.
Okay, so first one is Rujing.
The bell looks like a mouth, gasping, indifferent to the world, blowing in four directions. If you ask about the meaning of wisdom, it only answers with a jingling, tinkling sound. Dogen version. The bell is a voice articulating emptiness, playing host to the wind blowing in the four directions, expressing in its own eloquently crafted language the titibulation, the ringing of the ring.
Okay. There's different ways of translating that last line. It's kind of an onomatopoeia effect. You know, one thing about the bell is, you know, if you've seen the large Buddhist bronze bells, played a very important role in monastery life and in society in general, because they were the timekeepers, just as the, you know, the chimes are still used. But back then, before electronic clock devices and Seiko watches, you know, the bell was something you had to rely on to tell you when the day is transitioning. And so, you know, and a very powerful, beautiful sound up in the mountains, the bell would make. So, you know, there's a lot of symbolism and function to the bell. Okay, briefly, let's. What's the difference between Dogen's version and Ruijing's version? A lot of similarity, but the blowing in the four directions.
In Ruijing's version, the bell is sort of set apart from like everything else. You know, it's indifferent to the wind blowing in the four directions. Whereas Dogen makes it really intimate and sort of relational. It says it's playing host.
Yeah. Right. Okay. So I think in for Ruijing, it seems set apart. It's indifferent. It's an object that kind of has human features. It looks like it's a, you know, the opening looks like it's a mouth that's gasping, and you know, just changing the words a little bit. I think what he comes out with the symbolism that we're part of the bell. The bell kind of articulating emptiness. The bell is all encompassing. It's not just an object out there. And so the sound is embracing all of our activity, and the ringing of the ringing means that sound continues to reverberate. So let's finish off with another example where Dogen cites. This is on the bottom of page 3. Where Dogen cites a Ruijing verse, and you know, this several of these, of course, you can find alternative translations in Taigen's book, the Dogen's extensive record, and okay, this is so Ehei Koloku. This is the collection of a collection of sermons that or Dharma discourses that Dogen presented. That Taigen has translated. Volume 7, 530. For that part of the collection, there were 7 volumes of these Dharma discourses. And so this is the last volume. And I think there's 131 altogether, right? So
this 531.
Is, yeah, so this is the next to the last one. So it came towards the end of Dogen's life as he was... He got ill in his 50s and died a little bit prematurely at age 50 in his early 50s. But anyway, so this is one of the final Dharma discourses, and since we're running out of time here, I'll read it. By raising his eyebrows, he completes the dialogue. Now that's talking about a famous traditional. A conversation that was supposed to have taken place between the king and the venerable the monk. By raising his eyebrows, he completes the dialogue. He met Buddha face to face, and they did not hide anything from each other. Today, this is celebrated as an arhat. Pindala is celebrated as an arhat throughout the four corners of the world. Spring occurs at the tip of a plum branch wrapped in a layer of white snow. Okay, Dogen's version. He met Buddha face to face and they exchanged words. Raising his eyebrows, he tried not to deceive. By virtue of the Buddha's merit, spring flowers do not fade. In the jade forest, the wings of an ancient crane become even whiter. Well, in both of these, the first couple lines kind of recreate the original dialogue and celebrate the role of the monk. That becomes Buddha-like in the eyes of the king. And you know, as it, it's noted here, one of the chapters of Dogen Chobo Genzo called Baika, which means plum blossom, also has a version of this. And I guess Kenpo, so Dogen liked this story, talked about it in a couple of other places in his writings as well. And then the second half of the verse in both of them go to natural imagery and kind of approach the whole thing kind of indirectly by using something lyrical. And, you know, again, there's a lot of similarity. What would the and there's both have references to the plants and the forest and the world of nature. So any thoughts on the slight difference in feeling in Dogen's verse?
Did you read Dogen's?
Yeah, I think just to repeat Dogen's translation. He met Buddha face to face, and they exchanged words forthrightly. This is the bottom of the page. Raising his eyebrows, he tried not to deceive. By virtue of the Buddha's merit, spring flowers do not fade. In the jade forest, the wings of an ancient crane become even whiter. This is... Okay.
I think it's interesting, the last line, again, with the teacher, he's talking about the interchange or the tension there between the two seasons sort of slamming against each other, whereas Dogen is actually playing down that in this jade forest that you've got a crane that's always been white, and yet it's becoming whiter.
Mm-hmm. Right, it's always been white, right?
Right.
And then it becomes even whiter as it glides through the forest. So
it seems like he's emphasizing, I don't know, that enlightenment is always here, that it's always been here, but that our perception of it, so it's not that we were one thing and we become something else, but that we express what's already always been there.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it. So going back to the last line in Ru Jing's, spring occurs on the tip of a plum branch. Well, the plum branch, the plum blossom is the first flower at the end of winter. And it usually comes at the end of February. And the blossom is coming out, and then there might be another snowfall in early March. And you get that intersection of the seasons, and it kind of highlights the transition and the impermanence. And that's a very eloquent Buddhist image, I think. Dogen... Here, I agree with you, it changes it so that there's a little more emphasis on continuity, on the everlasting quality, the deepening of the whiteness rather than the transition. I don't think it's a better truth necessarily or even a different truth, but it, what he's trying to do is complement. So if there's a lot of emphasis on transitory, evanescent, impermanent in Ru Jing's, he's trying to give kind of balance it out by talking about the ongoing quality, and that the Buddha nature is always with us. Let me conclude with two final ones. So what I did, alternative translation of Ru Jing's verse. Well, what I tried to do there was to capture a little bit the sense of the... of the rhyme scheme in the Chinese, because the Chinese regulations would call for the fact that that you would have in the last character of each of those four lines AABA structure. In other words, the first two and the fourth line would rhyme, and the third one would be a different sound. And then it gets more technical. One other detail that I'll just mention is that the third from last character is supposed to have a tone that would complement the last character in each of those lines. That makes it a little bit more complicated, but just to show you the fact that these Zen monks were trying to and did do that. So to capture a little bit of the flavor of it in English, that's why I have question mentioned dimension, trying to rhyme those because that's the way it would appear if you were reading the Chinese. You'd get a sense of this being a rhyme scheme that would reinforce the poetic quality. Of course, we're used to rhymes in verse in English, and so you know the Chinese they had their own version of it. It doesn't always come through in the English because it's kind of awkward to do that. Okay, finally, one of my favorites in the it's not quite a poem exactly, but it's included in that part of Dogen's collection is "Mind Itself Is Buddha," which was one of the teachings that the Master Mazu was known for. And according to Dogen's brief comment, "Mind itself is Buddha, difficult to practice but easy to explain." And then Mazu was known for a later teaching where he reversed it and said, "No mind, no Buddha." And Dogen says, "Difficult to explain, but easy to practice." Is that true?
Yeah.
So you know, to me, that kind of sums up. But Dogen always has a knack for twisting things around, turning things topsy turvy a little bit in a very creative way. So, thank you. And
yeah. So while Stephen's here, I want to have thank you very much, Stephen. I want to have a chance for people to ask questions or make comments or have some formal discussion, and there'll be a chance to informally after this. Again, I think this last response to Mazu is very important. "Mind itself as Buddha is difficult to practice and easy to explain." "No mind, no Buddha" is difficult to explain, but it's easy to practice. I did want to mention, just because it's one of my favorites, one of the other poems that you have here, a very important poem by Dogen, "Special Transmission Outside the Teaching." So this is about the heart of the Dharma. This is on near the bottom of page 2. And I'll just read the English version. "The Dharma, like an oyster, washed atop a high cliff. Even the waves crashing against the reefy coast like words, they reach but cannot wash it away." So this is a wonderful expression of how fragile or how delicate or, in some ways the Dharma is difficult to explain, and yet we can't wash it away. We can't ignore it. So it's a beautiful poem that expresses that, and I appreciate your translation. I just wanted to say, to mention that.
Yeah, and can I follow up on
that?
Okay. One of the interesting things there is that, again, Dogen, now this is, he knew the rules of the Chinese verse, and now we're back to the Japanese side. And so one of the things they like to do is use puns, because there's a lot of homophones in both Chinese and Japanese. So characters that can be pronounced in different ways and can have different meanings based on the pronunciation. Very, very different meanings with the same pronunciation. In this case, the key one is nori. Nori is can mean the Dharma. But it can also refer to seaweed, depending. I didn't put the seaweed into it, but it has that idea of kind of getting washed, the Dharma being washed ashore. So the fragility of the Dharma, right? But yet it's going to hang on. It's not going to go anywhere. But it's going to take different shapes and forms and be affected by the environment.
So good, thank you. So we have a little bit of time formally and then more informally. If anyone has questions for Stephen about Dogen's poetry, or comments or responses, please feel free. Tom?
Yes. On the third page, at the bottom, Ryuji talks about what does he mean by arhat? What is that? And also, when Dogen says in that last line of that poem, "In the jade forest, the wings of an ancient crane become even wider," could you explain what that imagery means?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good. Let me take that one first. The Well, the ancient crane, you know, they talk about the crane of happiness. The crane was one of several animals that had a lot of symbolism in Japanese folklore, or in Chinese as well. And so, you know, the crane gliding off into the skies is kind of a symbol of transcendence and ongoing happiness. And there's a myth about an ancient crane that's with the white feathers that never got diminished, and the purity of that whiteness had remained. And so, Dogen's taking that a little even further, they become even whiter. So the Dharma, even though it's washed up in the other poem, it's becoming purer and purer. I think that's how I interpret the idea of the white crane. And, you know, from the standpoint of, you know, looking at the history of literature, one of the things we can see is how the Zen poets would often build on the folklore, the mythology, the legends, and try to give that a Dharma meaning, you know, put that into the poem. On the Arhat, well, the Arhat is, a technical Buddhist term for an accomplished master. And so it's a term of veneration. And so the idea is that the you worked a lot on this one. Did you want to comment on this one? No.
There's a particular story.
Yeah.
And I won't go into the whole story, but Venerable Pindola was an arhat. He had been fully self-purified. Arhat is the ideal in the earlier pre-Bodhisattva Buddhism of India. And the story is that he met with this king, and Venerable Pindola was very old, and he had actually seen the Buddha. And this is a long, long time after the Buddha's death, so after the Buddha passed into nirvana. So there's a story about Pindola and meeting with King Prasenajit, and he had these... Pindola is famous for very long eyebrows, and the king asked if he actually met the Buddha, and he just lifted up his eyebrows over
it. Kind of like Groucho.
Yeah. So, and bushy eyebrows is a kind of image for having read a lot of sutras or heard a lot of teachings. Anyway, but Arhat is the ideal before the Bodhisattva of the personally self-purified one.
Yeah, and I think one point would be that, okay, celebrate as an Arhat. Now, that could be a formalistic ceremony. So how do we internalize it? How do we really understand, grasp the significance of it? Yeah.
I think it's interesting, at least it seems to me, that Wu Jing stays much closer to traditional ideas and images and the poetic tradition. You know, in the first poem where he emphasizes about how his life has been committing terrible sins against heaven, and emphasizing his failings and failing to realize before the relationship of life and death. And Dogen is a little different in emphasizing that in this life of failure, he's also practicing. I think in the same way that the poem about Pindola's use of the image of the snow on top of the white plum blossom coming is that's a very common image. That's in the Chinese culture generally.
Yeah.
But certainly, you know, the whole idea of the plum blossoms in the snow, the heron in the moonlight, a silver bowl
right,
for the snow.
Right.
Those are very common.
Very common, yeah.
Dogen's images don't put them together explicitly the way so many of the other Zen poems would.
Right.
So he has the blossoms, but he doesn't come out and say they're white plum blossoms, and he has the white heron. But he doesn't say it's in the moonlight or standing in the snow. So I think the point's there, but it's a little more creative than suggested.
Yeah, he doesn't fall back on the convention quite as much. And so I think that's put very nicely. And, in most cases, we want to see the disciple out doing the master to some extent. And so Dogen's not the only one, but we can see that Dogen, something about the imagination of Dogen to just not keep it at face value and always revise, modify, develop it a little bit more creatively, I think, you know, it does come through. One thing about his teacher Ruijing was that what the Japanese scholars would say is that Ruijing was not very well known in that era of China. There were a lot of famous masters who were very well known. Ruijing is primarily known because of Dogen, because Dogen championed Ruijing, and so his name comes down in the history books. But at the same time, Dogen probably couldn't exist without Ruijing, so he has that template to play off of, but creatively.
Well, and that seems to be a pattern of his relationship with Ruijing and Ruijing's writings. Dropping off body and minds, maybe not quite what Ruijing said.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's interesting.
That's right. Very similar to the famous story of when Dogen was supposed to have gotten enlightened, and he said, "I dropped off body and mind." And that changed the wording a little bit from what Ruijing apparently said. So we see that, you're right, we see that pattern pretty much.
So one more question or comment before we close formally. Anybody, anything about Dogen or Dogen's poetry? Stephen Hine here, respond. Well, I'll ask a question then. Stephen, a lot of the Shobogenzo, which is written formally in prose, is known as very poetic. Can you say, and you've been talking about the formal poetry here today, which is what we're talking about, but can you say something about the poetic quality, a little bit about the poetic quality of Dogen's prose writing, like in his famous Shobogenzo essays?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Good. So... the word Shobogenzo is used in a couple of different titles, but when we say the Shobogenzo, it refers to a collection of essays, writing, sermons, discourses that he gave through his career. And there's different versions of it, but there's a 75-chapter version, a 95-chapter version, and translated in a variety of English translations. One's available, you can download on the internet, the full thing. It's not necessarily the most recommended one, but it's pretty reliable. Kaz Ta-Nehisi had recently a two-volume set of the translation. So people are, some of the chapters in that Shobogenzo must be 12, 15 translated versions in some cases, right? So people are very fascinated by that. Okay, so what I think happened is that at that point that Dogen was just coming at that point in history where you combine the Chinese and the Japanese. So he usually quotes the Chinese, and he must have had a great memory. Now we can search a lot of this stuff on the internet, but I don't think that was available back then. So when he came back from China, he might have had backpacks full of these scrolls and scriptures, but still, it's kind of uncanny, because if you look at the writing, he was able to quote verbatim, probably off the top of his head, these different scriptures that he had read in Chinese, and then he quotes in Chinese. But he knows his followers in Japan are not going to be able to really read or understand the Chinese, and so he wants to quickly not just translate it for them, but convey the essence of it for them in Japanese. So he kind of creates this hybrid Sino-Japanese approach here that just is, and always modifying. It's not just Ruijing, but all the other ones he changes around too. All the other teachers, he always says, well, they said it this way, but I would say it another way, in a spirit of inventiveness. Because of the conflux of all these influences and all these factors going on at the same time, in his mind, a mind that's always questioning. I remember hearing a talk, I think we were there together where Carl Bielefeld was saying that, Dogen was the kind of person that he would look, let's say he goes to a bookshelf and most people are reading, okay, these are these titles. And as soon as Dogen would see a word like like light, he would say, well, light, is that physical? Is that mental? Is it something symbolic? And he would always take off and think about all the different levels of meaning of it. His mind was probably always so active and reactive. And that's the feeling that comes across. Hard to put it into English a lot of times, but a lot of people are trying their best to do just that.